Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
We edited out of the essay, and I think I hope more for stylistic reasons than for content, but I think it's a really beautiful quote, and it's something that's very close to my heart, so I just want to start with that. At the end of Walden, Thoreau describes a story which has gone the rounds of New England, of a strong and beautiful bug which came out of the dry leaf of an old table of apple tree wood, which had stood in a farmer's kitchen for 60 years, first in Connecticut and afterwards in Massachusetts. From an egg deposited in the living tree many years earlier still, as appeared by counting the annual layers around it, which was heard gnawing out for several weeks, hatched perchance by the heat of an urn. Who knows what beautiful and winged life, whose egg had been buried for ages under many concentric layers of woodenness in the dead dry life of society, may unexpectedly come forth from amid society's most trivial furniture to enjoy its perfect summer life at last. So I spent a lot of time rereading Thoreau the last few years, and he's sort of known as a misanthropic hermit, actually, but he really wasn't that. He spent that time in the woods, but he spent most of his life in society, and he knew a lot about Eastern religion. And he knew Whitman, he admired Whitman, and latest biographies show, actually it's in the epilogue of the last biography, buried in some page, that it's now thought that he probably was a closet case, that he was a repressed gay man who really hadn't examined that part of his life. But when I think about that quote, you know, it's an obvious metaphor for coming out. But I think in a general sense, it reflects the fact that most of us spend a good part of our lives pretending that we are someone else, pretending that we're part of the furniture from our earliest lives on with our parents and then going on. And most of the time we relate that in our own lives to our life in society. But I think that the purpose of our lives is to reach the heart of living in each moment fully, which doesn't just reflect our relationship to society, but our internal conditioned habits as well. And so another thing that I had just said in the beginning of this essay was a quote from Joseph Campbell, who was known as an anthropologist, but I think was much more than an anthropologist, and who understood Buddhism very well. He said, "The privilege of a lifetime is being who you are. We must be willing to get rid of the life we've planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us." So he wasn't just talking about our relationship to society, but the conditions of our minds and hearts and our internal being as well, mostly, actually. Well, this leads me to a topic called renunciation. And it's used a bit paradoxically as I'm going to discuss it. Renunciation, as you see it in the dictionary, is to give up or to reject or to disown. And we think of it ordinarily as giving up something that's pleasurable, something that we like, something that we've had or want. But in this sense, it's used somewhat differently. And the text that I am referring to is by Pema Chodron, who is a nun, an old student of Trungpa Rinpoche's, and this is from The Wisdom of No Escape and The Path of Loving Kindness. And she says that renunciation is letting go of holding back. What one is renouncing is closing down and shutting off from life. And you could say that renunciation is the same thing as opening to the teachings of the present moment. Well, in a metaphorical sense, what could be more opening in relationship to that bug coming out of the wood, coming out of the woodenness of society, It's the same thing as coming out of the conditioned habits of our minds. Every moment of time has enormous energy in it, and we could connect with that. She says that renunciation is realizing that our nostalgia for wanting to stay in a protected, limited, petty world is insane. And that every time we're willing to let the storyline go, our conditioned habits are being stuck or frozen in that wood of our own mind. And every time we are willing to let go at the end of our out-breath, that's fundamentally renunciation. Learning how to let go of holding on and holding back. So it's about saying yes to whatever is put on your plate, whatever knocks at your door, whatever calls you up on your telephone. How we actually do that has to do with coming up against our edge, which is actually the moment when we learn what renunciation means. And then she goes on to describe a long story about what edge means. And basically, it's these are the obstacles in our lives. Anger, depression, anxiety, and all the situations that provoke those feelings, about gradually meeting them as opposed to running away from them, sublimating them, denying them. Just very gradually, gently, softly meeting them. And it's different for every person, and we can't avoid them. We can try to avoid them, but they come up against our lives every day in many ways. Sooner or later, we all meet our edge, our obstacles. And she says when we meditate, we're creating a situation in which there's a lot of space. That sounds good, but actually can be unnerving. Because meditation has the quality of bringing you up very close to yourself and your experience. And you tend to come up against your edge faster. It's not an edge that wasn't there before, but because things are so simplified and clear, you see it, and you see it vividly and clearly. So it happens in the space of meditation, and it also happens in the space of our everyday lives. And we are better able to deal with it in our everyday lives by practicing with it in meditation. And it doesn't necessarily have a negative quality to it, as, oh, we're coming up against our edge, here are all these obstacles, you know. There's a playful part to it also. She uses the analogy of ravens who play with the wind in nature. The wilder the weather is, the more the ravens love it. And after we spend years of dealing with this edge quality to life that we come up against in meditation, we can actually become friends with the situation, gradually and slowly. She says, the ravens have had to develop a zest for challenge and for life. And as you can see, it adds up to tremendous beauty and inspiration and an uplifted feeling. And the same goes for us. She's referring to her life on Cape Breton, where the ravens are in great numbers. Whenever you realize that you have met your edge, you're scared and you're frozen and you're blocked, you're able to recognize it because you open enough to see what's happening. It's already a sign of your aliveness. So the instruction, and this is very important, the instruction isn't then to smash ahead and karate chop the whole thing. The instruction is to soften and to connect with your heart and to engender a basic attitude of generosity and compassion toward yourself. So the journey of awakening is coming up against big challenges and then learning how to soften and open. The paralyzed quality seems to be hardening and refusing, but renunciation, as it's used here, is simply feeling the whole thing in your heart and letting it touch your heart and for your predicament and for the whole human condition. The whole journey of renunciation or starting to say yes to life is first of all realizing that you've come up against your edge, that everything in you is saying no, and then at that point, softening. You may say yes or you may say no to that particular situation, but simply softening into it. This is yet another opportunity to develop loving kindness for yourself, which results in playfulness, learning to play like a raven in the wind. Well, it's easier to talk about than it is necessarily to do in any given situation in our lives. For me, I first was hit with this in about 1984 when I was driving the kids to the soccer fields in suburban Denver, and we call, maybe some of you are familiar with the word arroyo, which is basically a dry creek bed. And I remember very clearly at 45 miles an hour driving over this arroyo and caked mud at the bottom of it, not a drop of water anywhere. And as I'm flashing over it, I saw the arroyo and I thought, this is my life. And I knew at that moment that I couldn't pretend to live that, I couldn't live that life anymore. I couldn't pretend that the stream was full when in fact it was a dry, caked stream bud. And that was the point of my life when I decided to leave a marriage of 17 years and all the consequences that had for my children, and which I have two children, and for career. So I think there comes a point when you can no longer pretend. But it's not just a process of coming out. I think it was very naive for me to think that by coming out as a gay man, those were the ends, that was the end of all problems. Oh, I've come out. It's clear sailing from here. Well, what you realize is that it's that old cliche, wherever you go, there you are, and you carry all of your baggage with you and all the habitual patterns and that have been with you all of your life. I discovered that I was still shy in crowds, whether they were gay or straight or in between. And then I had all my other little things that we all have. But that's what this whole process of renunciation is about, is being willing, either in practice in the space of meditation and in your daily life, to meet that edge and just gradually touch it. You can walk into it sometimes. Sometimes you have to back away from it. The whole practice is to be gentle with yourself and with it, and hopefully with the people that you encounter, as these two edges are rubbing against each other. Almost at the same time that I came out, I met Bill just a short while after, within about a year. Bill Sheen is my partner with the pale hair there. And for us, maybe at first unconsciously and later consciously, being in a relationship has been a process of, you know, edges meeting edges. And in this piece in Queer Dharma, I wrote a little bit about this. There's a psychologist named John Wellwood who's published a book called Love and Awakening, and he wrote an article called Partner, Lover, and Worthy Opponent. He was really addressing straight couples, but it goes for gay couples as well, and perhaps more so, in which he says that your partner can be thought of more as a worthy opponent than as someone with whom you're looking for mutual confirmation. You say yes to him, he says yes to you. And you live in this little self-enclosed cocoon where neither one ever challenges the other in its perfect peace and bliss. Well, as we all know, life cracks that cocoon constantly all the time. That's an illusion. And Wellwood suggests that perhaps a more fulfilling way of living and making life practice is to meet your edge in that relationship, whether it be discussion or conflict, whether it means of momentary acrimony, or good conflict by resolution, however it works in the moment, is to approach the relationship as a process of growth for both people. He uses some words that you may feel are flowery, words like sacred combat. At the time, it doesn't seem so sacred. an artful dance, you know. But I think this is good, where he says that the purpose is that the partner threatens to blow our cover. The partner doesn't necessarily say yes to everything that we think is true about ourselves. And this is really good for us and for the partner. It makes it very alive and vivid. And the ego's tendency to seek confirmation is thwarted in an honest relationship. I think this is really true for anyone who sticks it out long enough. So, I think it's particularly difficult for gay Buddhists to do this because, first of all, I don't think gay people really have a cultural, religious, or political matrix of support, really, which most of straight society has had for millennia. To back us up or to give us some guidelines as to how to deal with this, I deal with that at some length in the article. It's beginning, I think, nowadays a nascent gay culture, but it's in its very earliest stages, and a lot of it seems to revolve around self-pity, which is understandable in the age of AIDS. But there isn't a lot of honest respect, I think, in general society for gay relationships. I noticed when I first moved to our little town up in Sonoma that many, many trips over several years, I'd walk in the street and I was treated normally. But as soon as Bill and I moved there together, and we walked down the street with our two little dogs, there was always that edge of how are they going to regard us. And some of this is our own projection, internal homophobia, but some of it was real. And we did encounter instances where being in this space, this very straight, smooth space where everything is like Mayberry, that being a gay couple is something of a threat to some people. And we were meeting our edge by willing to be there. So, I think it takes some courage because there isn't the backup. There is really no backup, cultural, religious, or political, by and large. And when I say religious, I mean that in Buddhism, we're treated with a lot of tolerance. There really is nothing that I know of, despite the recent arguments concerning the Dalai Lama. There really is no broad proscription against being gay in most of Buddhism, at least in Zen Buddhism. And but there's also no real support either. You don't have a clergy as some of the Episcopalians have, where there are support groups, and gay people are treated very gingerly in some areas, and they're treated with a lot of support in some parts of Christianity. But in most of Buddhism, we're basically on our own. There are no props. There's no reward of heaven. All we have are groups such as this and ourselves. So there's kind of both extremes of opportunity and of challenge. The opportunity is that you can be whoever you are. There's no you're going to hell or you're going to be damned, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, there is no enormous rubric of support from the institutions, from religious institutions. My own path is that about 12 years ago, I went to I read Kepler Roshi's book and went to Rochester right away and joined that little, big sangha. And then in my first sesshin, the first day, we were asked to sleep in a basement room in urban Denver where we were wall to wall, hacking and coughing away, and urged to go in the middle of the night and rush to sit to gain enlightenment. And the next day, I just fled. After my first day of sesshin, and you know, I was urged to stay, and there was this group of three people that tried to keep me there, but I felt it really wasn't the right thing, and I panicked and I left, and I never went back. And then about 2 years later, I read Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi's book, which really touched me deeply, and I can't count the dozens of times that I've read it and just pick open a new chapter. And it seems fresh every time you read it. And look for one of his Dharma heirs as a teacher. And, you know, as things would have it, I went from one end of the country to the other. And Baker Roshi was nowhere to be found. And Kobun Chino was in New Mexico. And I got him on the phone. And he said in broken Japanese, "Go sit." What does that mean? And I went to see Glassman in New York. And that didn't seem right. And by default, almost, I wound up at Sonoma Mountain Zen Center, where Kwang Roshi is, and stayed, and came back and forth for about 10 years, three sesshins a year. And that was a very hard process. It was very hard sitting in a Zen setting. Sesshins, most of you are familiar with what Zen sesshins are like, or not? Okay. Just very briefly, they're very austere. They're very strict in a traditional sense. The schedule is very tight. You get up at 4:45 in the morning and you do 108 bows, and there's a whole schedule of 45-minute periods all day long, and work short rest periods, just enough to catch your breath but not enough to really rest. And the purpose is not to make you miserable. The purpose is to encourage you to stay away from your storyline, to be involved in whatever it is you're doing at the time, to encourage mindfulness awareness, whether it be work or meditation or bowing, and to surrender ego. But it has different effects on different people. And for many, many people, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I used to come back from these retreats a nervous wreck in Denver. And I would have periods of insomnia, and I would come back just very tired. And I kept at it for 10 years. And I don't think it was anybody's fault. I would discuss it with a teacher. And the reason I'm bringing this up in detail is because I felt at the time that this was meeting my edge, you know. And I'm a person who has strong self-expectations and expectations of others probably as well. But I thought that was meeting my edge. But it can be a very tricky, subtle thing. Are you meeting your edge, or are you simply denying something that's very clear and something that you need to change? Or is it just resistance, or is it a real obstacle that you need to do something about? It may be that after 10 years of sitting in Zen practice, the very next Sesshin would have brought me to some other space. I'll never know that. But after about 10 years of that, I finally decided that it wasn't useful, it wasn't helpful. And I think that's that spot where you have to trust your experience, your own experience, and there's nobody else that you can give that decision up to. It's a scary thing because there's nobody else that can who can tell you what to do. You really have to make that decision. If you have a teacher that you really trust, that person can be very helpful. I felt that after all those years that my connection with this particular teacher wasn't that strong, and I wasn't willing anymore to do what he told me he thought I should do. And you may have the wise counsel of friends, which can be very helpful. But I think ultimately you're thrown back on yourself, and this is the message I think in Buddhism again and again, is that although in one sense we're all interdependent, and everything we do relates to everyone around us, in another sense, we really have to rely on ourselves as to what we're going to do in our lives. And so after these 10 years of going back and forth and all these sesshins, I haven't been there for over a year. And in California, I've met a lot of people who, in their practice, their practice is really not a formal practice. I've been involved in some Sonoma County volunteer AIDS work, and I have been amazed at the number of people I've met who are not formal anything, who are not formal Buddhists, who are not necessarily Christians, although I met one fundamentalist, older Christian woman, who nevertheless have a very real spiritual practice, and who are meeting their edge, and who are exhibiting this process of renunciation, and who are living fully in the moment, in whatever they're doing, in a very compassionate way all the time. So I don't think it's necessary that everyone has to have a name on their practice. If you're living it, you're living it. Now my partner has been a Vajrayana Buddhist for decades, and part of this Vajrayana path is also the Shambhala practice, which is not, strictly speaking, Buddhist, but involves the intention of living and creating a sane society through a process of meditation and through involvement in the arts and in life as and in ordinary life as practice. And so for myself, where my practice has tended to go, into the Shambhala, Sonoma Shambhala Center, where we meet just as you meet here. And meditate in a somewhat non-sectarian way. So, what's the result of all of this? Where does this lead us to? Roshi, the teacher whom I ultimately decided not to practice with, once said that you know that your practice is working when it leads to a sense of openness in your life, when you are opening in your life. It's kind of an undefined word, but I think we all know what it means. When you're no longer restricted by your habitual patterns of thinking and action, and when you're no longer guided by all the storylines that are going in and out of your head, and you're open to the moment as it's happening, when that is increasingly happening in your life, then your practice is working. And it's a process of one step forward, three steps back, two steps forward. There's no linearity to it, I think, actually. But you just sense it over a period of time. And then another way of looking at this, which I think is very helpful, was given by Uchiyama Roshi. He wrote a book called Refining Your Life. It's a very small red book. I found that the smaller the books are, the better they are. Uchiyama Roshi wrote this wonderful book. The first part of it is Instructions to the Zen Cook, and it dates back to Dogen in the 1200s. But Uchiyama Roshi's part of this book, he says in it that everything that happens to you is your life. It sounds so obvious, but it's not about your life. Everything that happens to you doesn't affect your life. It is your life. And if we can really live that, to me, that's a sense of enlightenment, actually, if you really live that way. And other thoughts that I would just leave with you in terms of where this process of meeting your edge and renunciation leads to is a statement by Joko Beck, Charlotte Beck, who is a teacher in San Diego, an older woman, I think she's in her 80s now, a very sharp lady. And someone at a conference I went to once asked her, what is enlightenment? And he went on with the question, and she just went like this. And she said that enlightenment is when you get tired of your thoughts. Really? And here's this very old lady sitting there, and she said, I'm not fully enlightened or enlightened yet. And she actually said that she had not met anyone in her life, and she had known all the major teachers in America who she would consider fully enlightened. But she said she thought that the process was one of becoming tired of your thoughts, of your discursive mind. Or as Rinpoche said, Trungpa Rinpoche, we no longer invite our thoughts to dinner. So, and in a macro sense, or in a larger sense, I think if you're a Mahayana Buddhist, the purpose is also to create a world in which there is less aggression, a world of sanity, a world in which we respond to each other in a compassionate and kind way, but I think it starts with yourself. So ultimately, the result is an appreciation of being fully alive. And sometimes in your practice, you'll have this feeling not only of appreciation of your life, I think, but that everything is included. All the crap is included as well. Nothing is excluded in this process of appreciation, including some of the news that isn't so good. That's where I'd like to stop. Are there any questions or is there any discussion?
Okay. When you talk about softening to your edge, I wonder if you could be a little more specific about what that might involve.
Well, you mean in meditation or in everyday life? Or
both.
Both. Okay, it's easier actually giving an everyday life response than when I think of our relationship. I would say our biggest conflict in relationship has been around our children. Bill had two and I had two. And he tends to be a very chaotic person. I tend to be a very orderly person. And these kids, we'd have four kids every other weekend for 10 years. All those spaghetti dinners and all those athletic events. And we're, here we are, two gay men and not terribly athletic. And the softening is when those kids arrive at the door and my initial response is to close the door. No, I never close the door. But for me to run away, to go to another room, to try to diminish the contact and minimize the contact that I would have with those kids. And I think softening the edge or leaning into it is to do the best I could to encounter the situation without it becoming aggressive. And sometimes it did become aggressive. I mean, there were plenty of shouting matches. But there were times when it didn't have to happen that way. When I would enjoy being with them, they would enjoy being with me, and I would do this or that with them. And that's softening into it, I think. Or at work, when work is a more formal situation. When someone is doing something at work that you really are opposed to or you think is wrong, instead of coming at them with hammer and tongs, basically speaking to them in a non-aggressive way. And it doesn't necessarily mean being not being angry. I think anger can be a useful function, but it means not having a direct goal. I mean, aggression has a goal-oriented quality to it. And approaching the situation in a non-aggressive way. And in meditation, there are times when we become, in times of great stress, we become so completely lost. I mean, when we're sitting here on the cushion, you really can't come back. You can't keep to the out-breath, or you can't consciously say, thinking and let it go and let the storyline go. I think at those times, just sitting there and being a witness to your own confusion is a very helpful and wonderful thing, really. And there are those moments. So that's an act of softening. Anybody else?
I just love the metaphor of the bug.
It is a good one.
That was a great metaphor. Not coming out till I was 65, so.
Well, I came out was 39.
Yeah, uh-huh. But I just love that idea. Am I flying around like a bug?
And that was Thoreau's whole message. I really urge you to read or reread Walden if you haven't done so. Very contemporary.
I think I might.
How have you dealt with the situation of practicing within two different Buddhist traditions in your relationship? How do you deal with that?
Well, Bill considers himself a Zen student also because his first teacher was my Zumi Roshi from Los Angeles. So he has no problem with that whatsoever. In fact, he likes the rigor of Sesshin more than I do. I really felt toward the end that it was that I don't want to come down too hard on Zen because I think it's perfectly appropriate for vast numbers of people. But I came to the point where I would not put on those black robes one more day, and where I felt it was just very stale for me personally. And that's when I trusted that quality. I had no problem joining in the Shambhala group, which is an arm of Tibetan practice, because it's very gentle. The sitting retreats that we would go to would begin at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm glad you brought that up, Winston, because I think it's a very helpful point. They began at 9 o'clock in the morning. No one took attendance. Not that they do it Zen either, but they notice. No one took attendance. It would end at 5. There would be celebrations or feasts in the evening. And I found for myself, and everybody would be different, can be different. I found for myself, I did it for a two-week period a year or two ago, that the practice was as intensive and helpful for me as this rigorous, austere practice. And I think it just relates to who you are and what style is most appropriate for you as an individual. That's all.
You know, that just raises a thought and perhaps a question. As you're describing yourself and Bill and your reactions to this, what it brought to mind for me was the concept of balance in Buddhism. And the reason it brought that to mind, as you had earlier described yourself as a very orderly person, and Bill is more chaotic. And I thought that it was interesting that Zen, which is the epitome of orderliness, that you eventually found uncomfortable, but you said Bill was more attracted to it. And so I wonder, I've always found that concept of balance in Buddhism as very important for me. If there's a certain part of the path which is extending more into that where we normally aren't, or which we have not chosen.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's,
I don't know if you were building a comment.
Well, I think that is meeting your edge, right? Going into the unknown. I mean, Joseph Campbell, and I mentioned that in here, that his little metaphor of entering a dark forest, but not where there is a clear path that you see, because that's not a journey. It's entering the dark forest where there is no path. That's the hero's journey, according to Campbell.
You know, one thing I'd say in terms of our relationship, in terms of having different traditions over the years, is that they did grate on each other from time to time. My shrine is very Vajrayana, i.e. ornate.
I call it the cathedral.
Sitting there. So there was definitely tension sometimes with us about the Gracie time. You know, I have everything but bells and whistles, you know, bells and Dorje and all this sort of stuff. And Mike really is drawn to a more simple style, I think, in terms of practice. And I think that in terms of what Mike talked about in his talk, there was a lot of edge in that for both of us. His edge of stillness and, you know, my edge of wanting to fill things up are on the positive side of color. I think they really were helpful to us when we opened to it, and they were a disaster when we did.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the way that these traditions function in the culture from which they originate is important to look at, because a lot of people can be drawn for the wrong reasons into one of these practices, thinking it's a cure or something, whereas it's... I guess what I mean is it's to avoid feeling too cozy with the practice. Mm-hmm. You know, too much is like who you are anyway. maybe you need a challenge here. You know, and that seems to be what you're getting at, the relationship.
Right. Well, it's always that's always the question, is how much of a challenge is it? Is it an overwhelming challenge? Or is it something that you can deal with?
I found I'm a Zen practitioner, and I like the orderliness and the actually knowing exactly what you're going to be doing when you're in the temple. You don't even have to decide how you're going to sit down, whether you're going to put your arms like this. You know, everything's just ordained. And I've done a few sessions, and then I did a retreat in the Vipassana tradition with Eric Colley. Many of you know, and I was confronted with 45 minutes, and what am I going to do? I really wondered, why would I, in that tradition, it's a 45 minutes, and their practice of this retreat was 45 minutes sitting in a 45 minutes walking or whatever, I really could see very vividly how I wanted to have something to tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. And I had to figure out, and then now I figured out, but then I had to decide it was all right to do that. It was okay to do this. I want to walk quickly. Yeah, I want to walk quickly. If you want to walk and want to lay down on your back and look at the clouds, you can do that. You know, whatever. It was, any one of them was all right. So I really had to go through a lot of the interesting stuff.
Well, at the very opposite end of that is, how many of you know who Toni Packer is? And she split off from Kaplow's group in Rochester. And I don't think she calls herself a Buddhist, but her retreats, again, are very loosely structured, and the process of meditation is just, they call it just attending. You're just attending to whatever is happening in your mind, and you're sitting there, you can leave, you can come, just attending, absolutely no judgment. And when you notice, when you're starting to judge, you notice that you're judging, and you just come back to just attending. And it's... Yeah, kind of the opposite, and very, very loose.
Yeah.
I remember one part of your article, a little passage that I thought was wonderful, was when you were watching, I think it was a play, that was a gay play, and that had gotten a lot of praise and was, I guess, popular. I forget what the play was.
Falsettos, yeah.
What was the play?
Falsettos.
Oh, okay. Where it was just basically just honoring victimhood and gay lifestyles. And I just, because I had just seen Love, Valor, and Compassion, where I thought the same thing I don't want to step on his toes for that, but that that was touted as a very wonderful gay play, and I just thought it was just elevating victimhood into like a very desirable, attractive place to be. I wonder if you could just comment a little bit more about that, about how that relates to what you see in the gay culture.
Well, without getting too paranoid, I think that's how a lot of, personally, I think that's how a lot of straight society sort of rationalizes or manages to make okay, justify their toleration of us. We're okay as victims, mm-hmm. but we're not okay on, and this is where I think this tremendous,
we embrace that too.
Some of us do. I mean, but I think this is where this vitriolic opposition to gay marriage, mm-hmm. or the official sanction of being a couple, has come from. You know, it just raised the hackles of everybody. Even in San Francisco, the polls were narrowly against it, because I think that when you start putting yourself, when you're a victim, you're okay.
No.
But when you consider yourself on a parity level with heterosexual society, then there's something about that that's very threatening. Mm-hmm. And I think all of those plays do that, and I feel the same way. It's very disappointing.
I think we should have maybe just a couple more questions.
Sure.
In terms of time, so maybe we'll get somebody who hasn't talked yet.
Thanks. Yeah. You talked at the very beginning about the dynamics of gay relationship, and you touched on the opposite or the opponents. Yes.
We're the opponent.
We're the opponent. Yeah. Can you talk about how that works in your relationship, or how that dynamic is really working out?
I should really. We have a lot. You wouldn't want to see us. Well, this environment is really pretty.
I mean, it's a revolutionary concept in many ways, isn't it?
It is. It is an interesting concept. It's a rationalization for being brutal. No. We are. We have differences on very frequently, probably weekly. And sometimes they're very vocal. But I think over a period of time when you're with somebody, they take place in the context, hopefully, of a commitment to the relationship as a whole, so that you can disagree, not violently, but disagree in a very extreme way, and yet know that you're working towards a process of coming to some kind of resolution. But I mean, in a very concrete level, we can both yell and scream. We don't hit each other. But the point is that we know each other's neuroses fairly well after all these years, and we're not afraid to point them out to each other. If it's nasty and it's aggressive, that's probably not the right thing to do, but we sometimes do it, and afterwards we're sorry. I don't think it is the right thing to do. But most of the time, we're simply able to say, you're being really uptight and controlling. Or, like getting here on time to this talk, it's late, there could be traffic, that's me, and I'm saying we really need to leave on time, and he's busy in his bathrobe looking for some piece of paper somewhere, and I start to raise my voice, and you get to a certain point, pointing it out, and either the person responds, and usually he does, arguments ensue, but in our relationship we've learned how to deal with this, so that eventually, most of the time, it isn't aggressive.
So you mean it's a creative arguing?
It's creative because it actually undercuts your neurosis at some point. If you open up enough, if I open up to what he's saying about my lapse of physical ways, so to speak, I actually am a much more organized, disciplined person. It's not just practice in the formal sense. A lot of it's from living with Mike. And I think, in Mike's sense, he tends to be very controlling. And in a negative sense, very disciplined, in a positive sense. But my kind of undercutting his control trip has allowed him to relax and get the useful.
And it doesn't mean it doesn't mean that every month I might not think, or he might not think, what am I doing in this relationship? I mean, those thoughts do come up for both of us, and we say them to each other, and we think about them, and I want to be in this relationship.
Does there anybody else want to?
Well, we'll just stop with those two then.
I guess I've heard this comment said that Suzuki Roshi has said, give things a big pasture. And I guess I never understood that as well as maybe I do now, in the sense of the edge and having things get tired of things. For example, I mean, if you confine something in a really tight thing and don't give it the space to play, you can't really get tired of it. You're always with it. You're always riding it really closely. So that big field, I think, enables you to play with the situation and maybe develop an understanding of the edge in there. And then maybe eventually you get tired of it. I mean, you see through it, you see its dimensions, and you're not hooked up to it. But, I mean, to me it seems clearer, that big field metaphor now, with combining with the idea of the edge and letting things happen so you can finally see through them.
Yeah, I think that was a brilliant phrase of his, give your cow a spacious meadow, is what he said. Yeah. And then the other thing he said that goes along with that, which I think is important and relates to your question, is that, and it was another chapter in Zen My Beginner's Mind, is that you should cook your practice is cooking yourself through and through, but you have to know how hot to let the temperature go, how high you can let the temperature go in your practice and in your life. And it's different for each person. I mean, too high... too high. When the fire gets too hot, it doesn't work for the person or the couple. And if it's too low, then you're not meeting that edge enough. You're not cooking yourself enough. So I think the combination of what's the optimal temperature for you in your practice, the kind of practice that you're doing, and giving yourself plenty of space.
You two have been together a number of years. How many years?
14.
14. And you just said a minute ago that you said you do want to be in this relationship. And I wonder how you decide that yes, you do.
Each week. Well, actually, I'm not really. I'm being somewhat truthful in the sense that I don't think about it in that way. As a, do I want to be here? Do I want to be here all the time? But I feel that being in this relationship with Bill makes me feel much more alive than I would be otherwise, or than I am otherwise when I'm alone. Sometimes I like solitude, but living together in this interactive process makes me feel fully alive, even though there are moments when it's uncomfortable for both of us. And what more can you ask for than to feel fully alive?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we have time to announce. Who has an announcement?
By the power and the truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity, without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.